Welcome to Chair Chat, an online web series hosted by me, Jamie Harrison, the chairman of the South Carolina Democratic Party. Our goal in this series is to begin to look at political leaders, activists, and people involved in politics in a three-dimensional manner. We will move past the political caricatures to get to know the individual. So now, let's chat. Hello, I'm really excited about this next chat. I met our next guest when I was in 11th grade in National Honor Society in Orangeburg-Wilkinson High School. I interned for him when I was in college. I worked for him for 6 years on the floor of the House of Representatives. I call him the boss. Ladies and gentlemen, let's meet and let's chat with the boss, Congressman Jim Clyburn. Congressman, welcome to Chair Chat.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So, this has been an interesting year. I know that you just recently went to Selma with President Barack Obama, and you crossed the Pettus Bridge. And I know you watched the movie with your granddaughter, Selma. Tell us how that felt, being with the president, the first African-American president, and Congressman John Lewis, your friend and your colleague in Congress, standing on that bridge.
Well, it was almost surreal. I had gone to the pilgrimage, we call it, several times before. As you said, the second time I watched the movie, I watched it with my granddaughter. I've now seen it, watched it four times, but I watched it with my granddaughter, and it was kind of interesting. She wasn't all that connected to what was going on, even during the preliminaries, and she was there doing what high school seniors do, playing with her iPhone, whatever she had, until that bomb went off in the church. And then she straightened up, she put the phone away, and she started watching the movie. Wow. The next morning, I got a call from her asking, could I have lunch?
To your granddaughter asking you for lunch?
Asking me, could I meet her for lunch? I said, yes, I guess I can. And she suggested a time, I suggested another time. And she said, well, I can't go at that time because I got to go register and vote.
Wow.
When I got to lunch, she brought three of her friends with her. And we had lunch. She talked about having just registered to vote. And after the discussion, there was another one of her friends who had just turned 18. So they decided they had to go back to the voter registration office so that young lady could get registered
as well.
So I think that movie, from what I've heard of people, had that kind of impact. And I was thinking about all of that as the president spoke. He gave what I thought was probably his best speech.
Yeah. You were coming of age. I mean, you were in college during a lot of the civil rights movement. Do you feel, and I know you were engaged in a lot of activity here in South Carolina, but, you know, as we look through the history books and we read about what went on in Alabama and what went on in Mississippi, it seems like South Carolina, even though all of the same type of activity was going on here, you don't really read about it. You don't see it. Why is that?
I didn't find this out until way later in my career. The governor of South Carolina at the time, George Bell Timmerman, senior, and the publisher of the state newspaper entered into some unholy alliance, and their decision was not to cover this stuff, just pretend nothing was happening. And that's very unfortunate.
So in essence, the newspapers and the governor said,
it was like a blackout. So we won't cover this. And there were people, even to this day, who tell me how surprised they are when you find out that there's so much going on in South Carolina that they never knew. A few people know that Martin Luther King Jr. Always referred to Septimus Ponce Clark from Charleston as the mother of the movement. Now, the media decided that it was Rosa Parks, yeah. But King always called her, September Clark, the mother of the movement. So these things were taking place in South Carolina. I was a part of a group that attempted to sit in Orangeburg 2 weeks later on the 15th of February. But when we got down, time all the stools had been removed, and so the tops of them anyway, and so that was not going to be pleasant to try to sit on those pedestals without tops. And then we went back on March 15th, 1960, and held the biggest demonstration that had been held up until that point in the student movement. I never refer to all of this activity as a lot of my friends refer to it as a civil rights movement, because I think the civil rights movement is still going on. I call it the student movement.
The student.
It was a student movement. Even if you look at the history of the Confederate battle flag being on top of the State House, I don't see people treating that correctly. Mm-hmm. Why it went up there, why that flag was up there. There'll be people who will argue with you right now that that flag been sitting up there since the Civil War. That flag did not go up there until 1962. I was teaching school down in Charleston, South Carolina, when that flag went up.
And why did it go up?
It went up to celebrate the anniversary of the Civil War.
And they just never took
it down. They just never took it down. And it was up there illegally. And you will find that when I and others started to raise the issue, it's when the legislature then passed a law to put the flag up there. The legislature passed that law to put that flag up there. So that flag was up there all this time just because nobody bothered to take it down after the celebration was over. Bob McNair, when he was governor, knew that and decided just not to put the flag up there one day. And such an outcry. People went crazy. And people noticed that flag was not up there, and he got a little nervous and backed off and told everybody that the flag had been sent out for cleaning.
Well, Congressman, you're a pretty good athlete. You played baseball.
Right.
Everyone knows about you and your love for golf, but I think a lot of people don't know you're a pretty good bowler.
I don't know. I just had a real knack for it, and I got real good at it. I used to run up and down South Carolina. We would go from Charleston to Savannah to Augusta down to Jacksonville, Ocala, Florida. We did something we call pot bowling.
Uh-huh.
Now, pot bowling is something akin to hustling. I wouldn't call it hustling, but quite frankly, I made more money bowling than I made teaching school.
Now, you have this interesting story about Mignon, and when she was Commissioner Clyburn, who's at the FCC,
yeah.
When she was a baby and a bassinet. Can you tell us a little?
Well, you know, I was doing pretty poorly. Mignon was a baby, and I was teaching school. Back then, you only got paid 10 months out of the year. So there'll be 2 months in July and August when there was no money. And my wife and I both, I was teaching and she was a school librarian. And so Mignon was growing and we had the bassinet. And so one night I came home and from the bowling night, and Emily said to me that Mignon had turned the bassinet over. She's too big for the bassinet. We got to get a crib. I didn't have any money. So I got up the next morning. It was a Saturday morning. I got up that morning. And I went to the bowling alley. And there was a guy there that loved to gamble. And I said, well, I think that I can get that that crib today. So we started bowling around 11 o'clock that morning, and by 5 o'clock that afternoon, I left the bowling alley and went to the Sears store there
in Charleston
and bought Mignon their first crib.
In terms of golf, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, who's a better golfer?
Well, Barack Obama is starting. He is a new golfer. Bill Clinton's been around a longer time. So at the time I played with him, no question Bill Clinton was the better golfer. However, President Obama said to me last week that we got to get back on the golf course together. And I've talked to him on the phone since then, and he raised that issue again, which means to me.
And you're one of the few members of Congress that he's actually golfed with, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm told. But for him to be so anxious about playing, I think he thinks he's gotten his game good enough to give me a game. Yeah.
Well, Congressman, you know that there's a new show out now called, it's been out now for a few years, House of Cards. And in House of Cards, it follows the story of a House Majority Whip from the state of South Carolina. You know, I know a little bit of history. I know there's only been one House Majority Whip from South Carolina. What's your thought on the House of Cards and just the role of the Majority Whip? Because most people, they've never heard of what a Majority Whip is, and all they know is what they've seen.
Well, Jimmy, I watched the first two episodes. I'm not, I love history. Mm-hmm. I've seen Selma, as I said, four times. I've seen Lincoln. I watch historical stuff. I have a hard time watching stuff that just can't possibly be real. and all that stuff in House of Cards, it just can't possibly be real. And so I stopped watching. I have not watched anything but the first two episodes. Now, I thought I was going to watch them all, so I went and bought Netflix and all that kind of stuff. I think that's what you call it. But I ought to get my money back because I had downloaded a single thing since those first two. But, you know, the whip's job is to count the votes, whip the votes, mm-hmm. That is, try to get people to vote the agenda. You need 218 votes in the House for anything to pass. And your job is to get to 218. And of course, you remember, because you were my flow leader when I was whip. That can be a tough job sometimes, because people come to Congress, come to that hall, 435 people from all over the country. They come from different backgrounds, different demographics, and they don't all see the world the same way.
Yeah.
And so to be an effective whip, I think, you've got to be able to sit down with a person and let them know what it is that's in the legislation. And you got to tell them where the legislation can be helpful and where it may be harmful. And if you know something about somebody's district and you know there's something there could very well be a problem for them, you got to tell them. I don't think you should ever allow anybody to be surprised by something in the legislation. So if they are going to take risk, they got to know they're taking the risk.
Do you think all whips do that?
I don't think so. But I just think that that's what you should do. You just shouldn't ever, in any way, mislead people on the vote. A lot of people blame Obama for the bank bailout. That happened in 2008 under George W. Bush. And we did a deal because that was going to be a tough vote. And we Democrats pledged X number of votes. The Republicans pledged X number of votes. And when that vote went up on the board that night, and the Republicans did not come with the votes they said they were going to come with. We had the votes that we said we were going to give. And because they didn't come up, we failed. The vote went down. We went home over the weekend, though, came back the next week, and Democrats put up the additional votes that were necessary for it to pass because we knew what would happen to this country if we didn't pass that law. We would be in worse shape as a country than we were in the Great Depression, 1929.
Yeah. when you think about it, that was a historic moment where we could have.
Sure. People were numb. I'll never forget. I was getting ready to fly home, and got the call from Nancy Pelosi summoning us to her conference room. I had no idea what it was. So we walk in that conference room, and I look. There was Bernanke, Paulson. I'm like, what is this? And they told us, hey, the country is about to collapse. The financial institution is about to collapse. And they told us, we got to do this, or we would be back where we were in 1929. And I sat there, I'm listening, and everybody listened. No, again, when the meeting ended, everybody just kind of rose. Nobody talked to each other, walked out of the room. I went straight to the airport and sat there and just waited on my plane home. And I got home and I said to my wife, I said, hey, it's something bad about to happen. It was a numbing experience. I just can't explain how I felt. I don't think I was feeling anything.
Yeah. Congressman, I know a lot of folks have met their significant others, their spouses, in a lot of different places. You met your wife where?
In jail. Well, I have to explain that a lot. I mean, in fact, one elderly lady came up to me one time when I left that hanging, and she said, you better start explaining that, because I don't think people that. Well, it was on March 15th, 1960, when I was sitting in the Orangeburg County Jail. We didn't have co-ed jails. I was just sitting there waiting to be bailed out with 387 other students. And some of the students had gone back to the campus and figured out some creative ways to get food to us. And Emily came to the jail bringing sandwiches along with many other students. And she came toward me with this hamburger in her hand, and I was famished. I mean, it was like 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening. We'd been in jail since 10 o'clock that morning, and I was really hungry. And so I walked toward her and reached for that hamburger. She pulled it back, broke the hamburger in half, and gave me half of it. She ate the other half, and I was so grateful. I married her 18 months later. Now, I thought that was the real deal. I did not know until our 10th anniversary, when we were celebrating it with friends down in Charleston, where we lived at the time. And I was sharing with the guys, the ladies were up at the dining room table, and we were in the rec room, partaking in after-dinner libations, talking and reminiscing about school days. And I said something about how fortunate we were with our spouses. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I felt this presence at the door, and I look, and there was Emily standing there, and she says, that's what you think. And I looked at her and I said, what do you mean what I think? I said, that's how we met. And then she told me the rest of the story. What happened was, it seems that one day I was walking across the campus with the young lady I was dating at the time. She was standing in the dormitory window with her roommate. And she looked out and saw me walking across the campus. She said to her roommate, they did not make a good couple. He's going to be my husband. And I found out that she had been stalking me for some time. And so that little episode in jail, she knew exactly what jail I was in, and she came bringing that sandwich with a plan. And the plan worked.
Well, Congressman, I think that's a great way to end our chat today. Congressman, thank you again for being with us today. And thank you, because you're always welcome at Chair Chats.
On the next Chair Chats.
So, Governor, you come from a political family on both sides. Your father was in politics, your father-in-law was the Attorney General, and your wife is a judge in Maryland. And I think your son, Will, is helping you out on your campaign. So tell us more about your family and what now looks like the family business, which is public service.
Well, if it's a business, it's a nonprofit business. So I was one of six kids. And there were a couple of givens in our house. One is everybody went to Mass, and the other one was everybody votes. And I might add, votes Democratic.